Today is, of course, Mother's Day, and I am feeling a bit tender about that in a unique way this year because of my mom's health journey, at least the part of it that I get to share with her. That journey has an end in sight, and it's not an end that is about, it's not an end that's about healing in the sense of restored to a previous benchmark. So I trust that you'll forgive me if this gets a bit emotional at some points. It's a very deliberate engagement with things that I carry inside of me about my mom. And I do that unapologetically, but I do want to say that if I become emotional in the process, I hope you won't feel uncomfortable with that. I won't feel uncomfortable with that, except maybe on your behalf. So just that. I suppose it's really no surprise that that kind of an intersection for me in my relationship with my mom has got me reflecting on my own relationship with her and thinking sort of legacy-ish thoughts, you know? Thinking of what I carry away at the end of, in this season, but also after this season, after my mom is no longer here with us. My mom comes from a storytelling tradition. I feel like I've always known that in my bones. And I think I knew that all the way along at some level because of the way her parents could just launch off into a story at the drop of a hat. Also could provide an idiom for every situation at the drop of a hat. But I became more acutely aware of that during our most recent visit with her a couple of weeks ago. Some of you in this community have met my sister Karen when she was here to visit us from her home in Calgary. Karen is one of the podcast people in this community. She says that listening works better than watching because she can do it while she goes for a walk or gets some other kind of exercise. I think it might be because she's seen enough of my face to last a lifetime. But it's very kind of her to frame it the way that she does. And so in any case, she's part of this community, generally speaking, at a distance geographically. And right now, Karen is on a compassionate leave from her work as a clinical dietitian in Calgary, and she's living with my mom as her full-time kind of nutrition expert and caregiver. That is an incredible gift to my mom and to our whole family. I can't even begin to adequately express my thanks for that. As my mom is approaching the end of her life, one of the things that she's been doing is writing down some personal reflections. And she doesn't have a lot of energy at this point. And so the notes are sometimes kind of in bits and pieces rather than more comprehensive narratives, you know, beginning, middle, and end and all that. Karen, who is one of the most organized humans that I know, which is really saying something given the capacity of the person that I'm fortunate to be married to, has been compiling these and typing them up so that they will be a lasting record of these memories of my mom's, and they can be shared. And while we were there visiting, Kareen was helping her with this task by reading some of those notes out loud while Karen typed. Which, you know, not all of us can do that, but she can. She can actually type that fast. So this was like, this would be way more efficient than me looking back and forth all the time. You read them to me. And I was in the room where they were working. I was kind of coming and going. And so I kind of got a little sneak preview of some of this stuff. And one of the bits of story that I overheard was about what constituted entertainment when my mom was young. The key features were, quote, a couple of guitars and telling stories. So it turns out, I suppose one way to say it, is that it turns out that the ability to launch into a story or to answer a question with a story just like that isn't just sort of a folksy cultural preference. It's a craft. And while it may have been born out of a kind of necessity or a kind of environmental reality, I think it's been honed by generations of practice to the point where it's almost a reflex. Maybe not even almost. Stories are, of course, reflections of the point of view of the teller. They are expressions. They are interpretations of the worldview of the teller. To interpret something is, by definition, to explain its meaning. If you look up the word interpret, that's what the definition is, to explain the meaning of something. And so we use phrases like, I would interpret that to mean, in our common speech, both to acknowledge that when we interpret something, we're making meaning of it, and also to acknowledge that we do that from our own perspective. We do that with our own limited capacities and our own worldview involved. It's not a distant abstract sort of thing. If you were around last week or you caught up later either on Facebook or by podcast, you might recall that we spent some time exploring the idea that religions are cultural linguistic constructs. That was one of the ideas that we talked about a little bit. In other words, religions use the language and the symbols and the meaning-making structures of the culture in which they were formed to offer an interpretation, a way of looking at, a way of making meaning of the world. And we also talked about how normal it is for many differing religions to have at least some proponents within them that say, our religion came from God. It's a God product, not a human product. To use a bit of Christian imagery here, we could think of that kind of a perspective as a way of sort of baptizing the particular ideas or perspective from which they come or the cultural context in which that religion was made. That way of articulating or looking at that circumstance can also easily become a way of saying something that I think is much more problematic. Something more along the lines of, I may respect your beliefs, I may even find them interesting, I may find them beautiful, I may find them powerful, but in the end, my beliefs are superior to yours because mine come from God. Sometimes, if the culture or the subculture that's making the religion has enough broad cultural influence, so outside of its own particular realm of influence and function, we can get what we might call dominant cultural values. We can get values the culture broadly might generally affirm as right or belonging to that culture when they really are religious values. It's just that they've been so broadly disseminated and they've sort of woven themselves so thoroughly into the prevailing norms that they've become the way things are. Sometimes we can sort of lose sight of that. So some of you might read Jen Zarate's Free Press column called Next, which is tends to be fairly sprightly and current. I quite enjoy reading her. This column, this past week, was on rest, or earlier in the week, later last week anyway. I saw it early this week. And lots of the ideas that Jen talked about in there, about work and productivity in particular, and her journey with that stuff, and kind of taking some time with a therapist to learn that feeling productive is not actually an emotion, like productivity is not an emotion, that kind of whole thing. When she's talking about her ideas about work and productivity, a lot of the ideas she talked about in that column can be traced back quite directly to what is sometimes called the Protestant or Puritan work ethic. And this is a fascinating example to me of what I was just talking about because of how wide and how deep it is and because of how intertwined it is with religion and the claims that religion can make about the authority with which it sometimes attempts to explain the world. Protestant Puritan work ethic, sometimes also known as the Calvinist work ethic, is a concept that's found in theology, sociology, economics, and history. It's quite a widely disseminated idea. And it emphasizes, and this is fascinating, at least to me, so humor me if it's not fascinating to you, it emphasizes that diligence, discipline, and frugality come to be present in people, this is the tricky bit right here, when they subscribe to the values espoused by the Protestant faith, particularly Calvinism. If we would think about someone who is diligent, disciplined, and frugal as a good person, the argument that this ethic made historically was that the reason people have those values, if they have them, is because they're a Protestant, because they espouse to the values of Protestantism, Calvinism. Puritanism was a particular cultural expression of that. I'm not going to get into it today, but the summary of that is to say it's your right beliefs that make you a worthy participant in society. So If we dug into this a little bit historically, we would see that this is all tied up with the Protestant church trying to distinguish itself from the Roman Catholic Church, early 16th, 17th century England, as well as the way that as that movement emerged, the Protestants formed an alliance with the growing commercial business of that time to the point where they become a significant political force in Parliament. So that intersection between subculture and culture is very thoroughly intertwined at that point in history. The phrase itself, Protestant work ethic, was coined by Max Weber. I mean, this is in translation, but it translates pretty well, from a deeply influential, often cited work of his published in 1904-05 called The Protestant Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. So this just continues to be interesting in terms of that intersection. And in that book, Weber makes the argument that the Protestant ethics and values, along with the Calvinist doctrines of asceticism and predestination. I have to read this more in detail to find out what the link is to predestination, but I think it's like if you're queued up to be a good person, you're going to be a good person, and if you're not queued up to be a good person, you can't bust through that. But he argues that this Protestant ethics and values and Calvinist doctrine of asceticism and predestination are what enabled the rise and spread of capitalism. So that's the core of his argument in that book. And of course, not everyone accepted that thesis. There's some noteworthy opponents of it. But the concept is often credited with helping to define the societies of Northern, Central, and Western Europe, as well as the United States, and of course, to the degree that Canadian culture is shaped by European settlers, Canada. We might not think about this very often, but when we describe someone as a good, hardworking person, this is what we're talking about. That's what we're alluding to. The reason we might not know that we're alluding to it is because this is what happens as values travel in a culture, is that where they came from disappears. It becomes invisible, and they just are. So this is kind of a writ large instance of how religious values can become mainstream or dominant cultural values, and how a local cultural linguistic product can become so common that its history disappears and it just becomes, as I said a moment ago, the way things are. It's how this is how the world works around here. Now, back to the connection with what my mom taught me about interpreting religion. These are not lessons that my mom taught me explicitly. At no point in my memory do I ever recall her sitting me down and saying, "Now, little Timmy, here's what I think you need to know about interpreting religion." Not a conversation we had. In fact, these might even be lessons that my mother did not mean for me to learn or credit her with. If she hears this, Mom, I don't know if that's especially likely at this point in your life, but still, I just want you to know that this is my interpretation of your interpretation, so you might need to sit me down and adjust my perception. I'm open to that. These are lessons that came to me, I would, you know, kind of by osmosis, by living next to them. And they came more clearly into focus for me once I started to consider my religion of origin as a cultural linguistic artifact, as a human product. That was what freed me to learn some of these things from my mom. And it's what was made in response, that the idea that religion is what we make as humans in response to a mystery, that was a super important key, too, to unlock my ability to learn some of these things from the way my mom lived her life. What I learned from watching my mom live out her path was that religion is something that we assemble, which means it's something that we can mess with, that we can disassemble, that we can change, that we can reassemble if we choose to, and so on. Anyway, to the lessons. Lesson number one. Again, Mom, if you're watching or listening to this later on the podcast, know that I know I'm not quoting you. Lesson number one, your religion should teach you to do what's right, by which I mean what is just. But if it doesn't, ignore what your religion teaches and do what's right anyway. So that was lesson number one. And let me just say before I attempt to illustrate this that I know that every one of these lessons is loaded with complexity. So this one, for instance, leaves open the question of who decides what is right or just. And if you give it a kind of a quick pass, it could seem to imply that that decision is really a completely individual thing. And that is not what my mom believes. I've watched her engage in community over her whole life, and you can't really fully engage as part of a community if you actually believe that. Does not work. Those things are mutually exclusive. But within shared belief, there is also room for, here it is again, interpretation, for meaning-making. And sometimes the meaning-making that we do as human beings is deeply contextual. It's always contextual. Sometimes it's deeply contextual and individual. It happens in particular places at singular moments in time under never-to-be-repeated circumstances. Our individual actions might be deeply informed by the collective, even accountable to the collective in many ways, and yet we are still responsible for our choices as individuals. So it's a both and. It's complex. My mom is the kind of Christian for whom the example of Jesus is a very real embodied image. And you might know the Jesus story or have heard the Jesus story where he goes into the temple, starts turning over the tables of the money changers, of the people that have occupied a place of holy mystery and turned it into a place of not just transactions, but of unjust transactions. And the religion of the day, the religion that Jesus was from and part of, said that was okay. But to him, it didn't look that way, and he wouldn't be a part of it. So the way the story portrays his reaction is a matter for another day. There's a lot of interesting scholarship about what kind of story that is. But maybe for now it can just serve as an interesting instance of what I was talking about a moment ago when I talked about how we make these decisions in the moment, in the context we're in. Like I said, loaded with complexity. We sing a song about this here sometimes, turning over tables, tearing down walls, building up the bridges, this contrasting idea, building up the bridges between us all. That's the part that I'm talking about. There are lots of walls that get put up in the name of religion. Lots of barriers. Lots of us versus them. I never saw my mom toss any tables, literally. But I did see her mouth tighten up and her brow furrow with a kind of don't mess with me fierceness when she had to face down religious values that built barriers between people. When she had to or chose to say, that's not right, and I won't be a part of it, even if it meant making a relationship more complex or losing a relationship or losing a business opportunity or some other perceived gain. Lesson number two. If your religion says that you should love one another, it's describing a practical mystery. My mom taught me that loving one another, like recycling, starts hyper-local. Starts at home. And it's practical. Sort of like recycling. The philosophical part of me, personally, sometimes wants to keep this all more distant, you know, more in the realm of ideas, because ideas are kind of just, you know, just a little bit further away. But love, by its very nature, assails that. It does not work that way. Love one another, at least in the hands of my mother, has practical implications. It is connected directly to serve one another, even when you might not feel like it. Now, I get that intersection right there, love one another even if you don't feel like it, I have watched and personally experienced how easily that can be twisted into love others even if it damages you to do so. This is not a hazard-free intersection. That problem right there, I think that's a problem that the rabbi saw coming when he said, love your neighbor as yourself, making explicit what many of us are still learning the hard way, which is that it's hard to love anybody else if we haven't learned how to love ourselves. And maybe that's where the mystery part of this comes in, the practical mystery part. If love is self-donation, we can't do it if we don't have something to donate. As my maternal grandfather taught my mother to say, what's in the well is what comes up in the bucket. Taking care of you means taking care of me and us taking care of one another. Without that mutuality, without that dynamic, whatever else is happening, it's probably not in good health. This wisdom is wisdom that both the Hebrew and Christian tradition says satisfies all the requirements that right living might demand of us. That's the summary of the whole shebang, no matter how many volumes it might fill otherwise. How that happens in the moment is, like I said, a practical mystery, not a law. I think I could keep this going for a long time in terms of lessons my mother has taught me, but just one more, and then we're going to sing together, and we'll call it a day in terms of this part of what we're doing. And then maybe we'll just all go in the kitchen and crawl through a tunnel with kids or something. That's what's been happening over there, by the way. It's been a lot of action. Lesson number three. My mom taught me that when it comes to religion, as in the rest of life, it's what's on the inside that matters most. In my mom's story, I sometimes wonder if all of this for her goes back to being raised in circumstances that could fairly be called poverty by most contemporary standards, When my mom talks about her childhood, she often says something like, yes, we were poor, but we always had food to eat and clean clothes. Sometimes they were patched, but they were always clean. And yes, that is the Puritan ethic. Right there, just perking along. When I look at pictures of her as a little kid, which I've had occasion to see a lot more of those in the last while as Karen's been compiling things, sort of archiving a story, I see that she's not making that up. That's what I see in those stories. I see those stories in those pictures. And when the small northern community church that I grew up in got a bit more established and decided to build a building, I can remember both of my parents, who were pillars in that community. My dad's construction company built the building. You know, they were in it up to their eyebrows, right? I can remember both of them expressing concern that the community would get too caught up in infrastructure demands and lose sight of its essence, which was people and relationships. My interpretation of those sorts of experiences is that all a building truly says about a community in the final event is that it has made it a priority to have a building. Good things might happen there. Ordinary things might happen there. Atrocious things might happen there. It's not about the building. It's about the people. And when the outside, when the appearances, whether that's building or otherwise, when the appearances become more important than the insides, more important than the people and the relationships, then that religion or that expression of religion is either in danger of or has already lost its grip on what matters most. I know that's a bit strong. I don't even care. It's what my mom taught me. I'm going to leave it there. Mom, I'm grateful for the lessons you've taught and will still teach me. I know I'll interpret some of them differently than you might have intended or wish. But I also know that you'll love me, even if I don't always see things the same way that you do. I believe that because I know that you believe that love matters more than getting it right. And when it's all said and done, I think that's the most important lesson you taught me, and the one that is big enough that it applies to everything, including religion. Happy Mother's Day, everybody. Peace.